Welcome to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. This episode recorded on Friday, the 12th of April, 2024. From the Farmers Weekly News Desk, I'm Johan Tusker.
And I'm Sandy Kirkpatrick.
In this episode, a new code of practice. But will it really prevent landlords from mistreating tenant farmers?
Fidder Fuel plans for a huge solar farm to divide communities in Wiltshire.
With our regular market roundup with a special focus on spring lamb prices.
And we take a drive with a 60-year-old farmer driving a 60-year-old tractor for charity.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
But first, the government has relaxed its flood compensation rules after one of the UK's most flooded farmers found himself ineligible for emergency funding. Henry Ward, who farms at Short Ferry, east of Lincoln, was left needing a boat to reach his farmhouse, which is surrounded by floodwater. Aerial footage of the flood-hit farm has been shown on TV, but Mr. Ward was told he wouldn't be receiving a £25,000 compensation payment because his farm is more than 150 metres from a major river.
I'm still sort of beyond words, really, that we're not eligible. But there's three things here. One, we've got a river that's not eligible. Secondly, though, if it was eligible, there's this stupid rule that eligible parcels have got to be within 150 metres of the centre of the river channel. Well, we've got a mile-wide lake still today. That means even if it was eligible, I wouldn't be able to claim for these parcels further than 150 metres away from the centre of the channel, which is ludicrous. And then thirdly, £130 a hectare flat rate payment. Well, frankly, my pre-emergence programme on my week cost me more than that, I think. It's nothing. If I'm not eligible for the full £25,000 here at Short Ferry, being the focal point of the media and the country's most famous flooded farm, if I'm not eligible for the full £25,000, I want to meet who is, because it's just staggering. I'm pretty lost for words, to be honest.
And in all seriousness, I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, I've seen that you're saying it's just becoming too risky to farm.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. This farm, so it's not the only land I farm, but this 200 acres of arable land here, it's the best soil I farm by far. It's grade one, grow anything on it. But we've got a mile of raised riverbank adjacent to the farm that the Environment Agency is saying, and it's substandard. It's for a layman term, it's knackered, it's slipping, it's ruined. So it's just, when we get a high rainfall event again, it's just going to go again. So I cannot risk planting any sort of crop on this land. So short-term SFI, it's all going into, and I hate it really, because it's prime agricultural land. It goes against everything that I really stand for. But I've got to act pragmatically. It's all going to be going into winter bird food in the short term. Medium term, looking at these other SFI options that will be coming out. We haven't got the detail yet, frustratingly, about connecting river and floodplain habitat, making room for water, all the rest of it. But really, we need to be thinking much bigger here. And I'm willing to work with the Environment Agency, set up a flood storage area, turn it into a nature reserve, this farm. It's painful to say it because I want a farm, but you've got to be realistic. But we've got to be paid for it. You know, we're saving houses, 7,000 plus houses in Lincoln from flooding. You know, we're supplying that public good. We need some public money for it. Otherwise, frankly, I'm going to be bankrupt.
That's Lincolnshire farmer Henry Ward. Well, the NFU said numerous flooded farmers were in a similar position, ineligible for the payment from the Farming Recovery Fund. NFU Vice President Rachel Hallis took the issue up with DEFRA, saying the fund simply wasn't working. DEFRA has now relaxed the rules, saying the eligibility criteria for the scheme has been updated to fully remove that 150-metre limit. This means that farmers will now be able to receive payments for all land parcels which are flooded contiguous to an eligible river.
Maybe not an error, Johan, but I'd certainly say it's an oversight to allow a situation like this to happen. And whilst Mr. Ward's might be in the extreme end of the scale, it's certainly impacting a lot of farmers up and down the country. And a lot of farmers are facing the prospect of losing significant income due to flooding.
Yeah, absolutely crazy bonkers, Sandy. And thank goodness there has been this outbreak of common sense at DEFRA, and they've realised the error of their ways, this oversight that they were only going to pay compensation to farmers, to flooded farmers who found themselves within 150 metres of a major river. Well, that rule has now been relaxed, and thank goodness that farmers like Henry Ward will now receive some compensation for the hardship that they have suffered. You know, as you heard, Henry's farm has been underwater for weeks on end, and not for the first time. We actually featured his farm on the front page, on the cover of Farmers Weekly in November 2019, when he first hit the headlines, surrounded by floodwater, only reachable by boat. And while this is putting his livelihood at risk, it is actually protecting thousands of properties in the city of Lincoln, there to the west, and it means that his farmland is flooded, but their properties, their homes and businesses are not. And every time this happens, he's left wondering whether he has a future in farming. Well, this outbreak of common sense, as it were, suggests that for the time being, he perhaps does. It won't go all the way to putting things right, but at least it will go some way to putting things right. And at least DEFRA has relaxed the rules, so more flood hit farmers are eligible for payments.
Are you going to Transition Live? The Farmers Weekly event to secure a sustainable future for your farm business. Meet like-minded farmers, listen to inspiring speakers, and share innovative ideas. A great day out for a great farming future at Cambridge University Farm on the 9th of May. To find out more and to book your place, visit fwi.co.uk/transition-live. That's fwi.co.uk/transition-live.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, tenant farmers are calling for talks with landowners who want to take back farmland so they can be eligible for inheritance tax relief. Trustees of the privately owned Lowther and Lonsdale estates in Cumbria have served notice on tenant farmers as part of a restructuring plan. About 120 tenant farmers could be affected across some 48,000 hectares. It comes as DEFRA published a new code of practice to regulate the conduct of landlord-tenant relationships in England. Robert Martin is chairman of the Tenant Farmers Association.
We are seeking an open and frank dialogue between the landlords and the tenants to find a way forward in this situation. We understand when we speak to the tenants that it's all to do regarding the estates rearranging their activities to meet the inheritance tax rules, a case that went through the courts and it allowed landlords to utilise that for pulling commercial property in among land for sorting out the inheritance tax that is payable by the estate. DEFRA have already started to help. They brought out the new code of practice. That's how landlords and tenants behave. But really, you shouldn't have to tell people how to behave. And also, we've seen that the review of ROC into tenancies is also asking for a tenant farm commissioner, which will hopefully oversee this code of practice. And we are hoping to hear from DEFRA in May about that particular role. The estates both know where they are today. They know where they want to be, but they don't know how they're properly going to go from A to B. And one thing we said to the tenants at the meeting at Penrith last week was that they are part of the solution to the estate's problems.
That's Robert Martin of the TFA. Phil Stocker of the National Sheep Association says landowners are also taking back land to get involved in large-scale tree planting, rewilding and other environmental projects.
What I think we're seeing is that you've got farmers that have got smallish farms, say 100, 150 acres. It might be on a full agricultural tenancy or might be owned. And then they've managed to retain their viability over the last few years by taking on additional land through, short-term grazing lets and five-year FBTs. And that expansion has allowed them to maintain or retain a level of viability. And I think what we're seeing now is some of the land that was on those five-year FBT lets is being clawed back, and the land owned by private owners or big estates is being clawed back to take into other purposes, I guess. And those farmers then, those tenant farmers or smaller farmers are being squeezed back into a box, which is challenging in terms of being viable. So we're seeing some increasing, and I would say that this is something that's been happening for a long, long time, partly linked to HLS schemes as well and stocking rate reductions and all sorts, but it's definitely speeding up at the moment, particularly in the north of England, I would say, is quite alarming.
Mr. Stocker went on to say that the situation was an unintended consequence of some of the government's policies for agriculture.
And this sort of relates more into some of the bigger schemes, landscape recovery schemes, and the other government policies around carbon credits, tree planting grants, biodiversity net gain, which aren't direct farm support schemes, but they are environmental schemes that are possibly encouraging some of the landowners to start to look at using their land for other purposes than farming. And it probably is an unintended consequence. And of course, while it's having a direct effect on farmers, it's also, what we're not picking up yet is the impact that this is going to have on local rural economies and local infrastructure like schools and pubs and those sorts of things that everyone else relies on. So, the danger with all of this is that so many of these actions and policies come in, and it's some time down the road before we see what the real impact of them are. And then sometimes, sadly, it's just too late.
That's Phil Stocker of the National Sheep Association, and we'll continue to keep a watching brief on that story as it develops.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Hi, it's Andy from KWS. Have you signed up to my KWS? It is full of helpful tools for all of our crops, including cereals, oilseed rape, sugar beet, and maize. Visit kws-uk.com to find out more and sign up for your free MyKWS account.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
You're listening to the Farmers Weekly Podcast. Welcome along wherever you're listening to us from. You can email us at podcast@fwi.co.uk. You can also send us a text message by texting the word farm to 88440. That's text the word farm followed by your message to 88440, and we'll read out your messages as long as they're not too abusive. Do tell us what you're up to, what you've been up to, what you're hoping to get up to, whether you're calving cows, whether you're lambing sheep, or indeed whether you're just sitting there waiting for it to stop raining so you can get on with some field work. Sandy, the magazine this week, what are you seeing?
Plenty of good stuff in the magazine this week, Johan. The first story that caught my eye is a snippet on page 8, which says vertical farming company to grow crops in orbit, which all seems rather futuristic in my eyes, if I'm honest. The company had been awarded £1.5 million by the UK Space Agency to develop an in-orbit space farm. And the chief scientific officer has said that as we go further into space, the more we will need to produce whilst we're there. I think that £1.5 million is probably better spent in UK farming on the ground than it is in space, but that's just my 2 pence worth.
I don't know, Sandy, even astronauts have to eat, and it's better than taking a packed lunch into orbit. Back down to Earth in the livestock section, 5 ways to ensure a safe and successful beef calving this spring. A thorough grasp of cow behaviour and the calving process can help create a safe environment when help is needed. We've got some expert advice there, courtesy of Michael Priestley, who says rarely a year goes by without health and safety executive records showing that a farmer or farm employee has been killed by a beef cow at calving. And I did see on social media exactly one of those incidents taking place, a freshly calved cow turning around and setting about the calf, and the farmer involved in the pen trying to rescue the calf and almost getting into a nasty mess himself. Four pages in the livestock section on how to ensure calving takes place as safely as possible.
Always worth taking extra precautions at this time of the year, Johan, irrespective of how experienced you are as a stocksman, particularly with young calves at foot. And there's another article on page 14 who's talks about the farmer taking a proactive approach to worry to sheep worrying, which again is another issue that we've seen at home on our own farm, but also around the country as well. And a farmer and a gun dog trainer have joined forces to take a preventative approach to livestock worrying by dogs. And what they're actually doing is working with the public to teach them and run classes to explain the situation that they have on the farm in terms of lambs and sheep, and also what the owners can do to keep their dogs safe and to stop them from worrying sheep. So a really nice story in working with the public rather than against them to try and tackle what is a difficult and what can be a very demoralising experience if you've ever experienced it on your farm.
In the machinery section, Country Car, the new Nissan X-Trail, which gets a new hybrid powertrain. Nissan's latest X-Trail promises to end range anxiety by having both electric motors and a petrol generator on board. And James Andrews finds out it can deliver with a quick look also at other X-Trail models, the specifications, and of course, the likes and gripes. All that and more, two pages in the machinery section.
Once you've bought your machinery and you've got some extra cash lying about and are looking to buy some more land this year, then apparently there's going to be more land for sale in 2024 with many factors at play. The so-called 3Ds, death, debt and divorce, are cited as the most common reasons that land are put up on the market. But there's also going to be a lot more smaller blocks of land. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with increased interest rates. And you can read that article and get a feel for whether or not it's going to float your boat. And you can see what's available on the market at the minute.
It's all about the weather in the arable section. Crop Watch, our crop consultants from across the country, give their insight into agronomy issues for the season. Neil Watts from Matford Arable in Devon says the weather continues to dominate everything in the southwest. It's a similar situation for Ian Richards from Agri in Oxfordshire. And we also have a report from David Martindale of the Arable Alliance in Yorkshire talking about backward oilseed rape. And Ben Pledger from Pharmacy in Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire says that land is starting to dry out a little bit to allow spring drilling on heavier soils. But he also points out that septoria is being found in nearly every field. So the latest arable agronomy reports across three pages there from some of our Crop Watch consultants. All of that and much, much more in this week's issue of Farmers Weekly, from your village shop, from your newsagent, and also available on subscription at fwi.co.uk. But for now, the markets. The finished steer deadweight all average is 488.2, down from 489.9 last week. The finished steer live weight, 274.1, down from 276.4. Into the sheep rings, the lamb's old season deadweight SQQ is 829.5, up from 816.3. The live weight SQQ also up, 393.9 from 381.2. The arable markets, feed wheat is 168 dead, up 50 pence on the week from 167.5. Milling wheat, 234.1, a dip from 235.4. Feed barley, 152.8, up from 149.4. Oilseed rape is 355.4, down from 359.5. Feed peas are £10 up on the week to 260.6. Feed beans also up £10 to 256.4. And our Wednesday morning ring round puts red diesel at 80.6 pence per litre. That's up half a penny on the week from 80.1 pence last week. Now, we are going to take a special look at the record-breaking lamb trade this spring, which appears to have hit its peak, but remains above £8 per kilo, Now, earlier Farmers Weekly's markets editor, Charlie Reeve, caught up with Johnny Williams, Joint Operations Director of Marketing Cooperative Farm Stock Scotland, who says the lamb trade has been very volatile, but is being driven by an emerging shortage of hogs.
We're just seeing really huge shortages of numbers of lambs coming forward, hogs coming forward. And we've had Easter, we've had Ramadan, and now we've got the Muslim festival of Eid at the moment, and that's driven a huge demand. We've got massive demand from the continent for exports of UK lamb, and so we've seen these huge prices never ever seen before. It's instinctively you think, wow, this is great for the industry, but obviously, you know, we need to see what's going to happen long term to see what the implications are for the lamb crop, which is just getting born at the moment.
Are we seeing more resistance from buyers at these prices?
Obviously, buyers wouldn't want to buy things as cheap as they can, but it's been very much like people have been keen to buy as much as they can. Everyone appreciates prices are buoyant, and it's all been about securing supplies rather than, it's all about, because lamb volumes have been so tight, it has just been, you know, trying to grab everything they possibly can, and it's been a very different market to what you might normally experience at this time of what you might normally experience in the sheep trade.
With supply tight at the moment, do you see prices staying supported in the short term?
Short term, I think so. Prices will stay well above the market, you know, well above the 5-year average. But we're going to have a late spring because of the terrible weather we've had, so the spring lambs aren't going to come into the marketplace in any sort of significant volumes anytime soon. Hog numbers are very, very tight, and the ones which are there are struggling to finish in the weather. You know, we've had massive demand. We've got really strong demand from the continent. So yeah, I can't see any reason short term why prices are going to change significantly from where they are.
That's Johnny Williams from Farmstock Scotland talking to Farmers Weekly's markets editor, Charlie Reeve, who joins me now. Charlie, a record-breaking lamb trade this spring.
Yeah, it really is. Prices hitting new record highs throughout March, actually, and they're still pretty strong in April as well. So we've had deadweight prices still in excess of £8 per kilogram and live weight at nearly £4 per kilogram. I think it is still relatively supply-driven, to be honest with you, tight supply throughout. In March as well, we did have Easter and Ramadan and those sorts of events. But I think this is predominantly supply driven.
And you've also spoken to some other auctioneers as well, Charlie?
I have, yeah. And I mean, at auction markets, the trade's doing very well as well. Some farmers are receiving more than £200 a lamb for the very best. So, yeah, I think this is needed, though. I think this sort of high prices is needed for a bit of morale in sheep farming at the moment. It's been a tough year for lambing with wet weather in Schmallenberg, amongst other issues. So, yeah.
And the coal ewe trade then?
Yeah, coal ewes are also very strong at the moment. So you've had coal ewes, some of the top ones going for £200 a head as well. And averages down at sort of 137 a head this week.
And going forward, what can we look forward to?
I think supply is going to stay tight, which will help support prices. I mean, looking seasonally, it's likely to be a gradual decline you'd expect, as happens most years. But early lambers, the spring lambs are slow to the market, so it might not drop off too quickly, potentially.
Farmers Weekly Markets editor Charlie Reeve, thank you very much. And that's your markets for now.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
Now, landowners and farmers in the Cotswolds are being given the opportunity to swap soil for solar. But at what price? More than 2,000 acres of Wiltshire farmland has been earmarked to create Limedown Solar Park, one of the largest solar parks in the country. But it's dividing the local community. Campaigners against the project say they're not anti-solar, believing panels should be located on industrial sites and alongside motorways, not on productive farmland. Farmers Weekly's Georgie Green went along to a public meeting organised by North Wiltshire MP James Gray, where 650 people turned up to air their views. Georgie spoke with Tracy Worcester, whose ex-husband, the Duke of Beaufort, is planning to hand over 200 acres of estate land to the project. But first, James Gray explains more about the reaction to the development.
Well, this whole thing came from nowhere about a matter of a week or so ago. Apparently, a number of landowners had been negotiating with the developers for some years in the past, but suddenly the developers turned around and they announced, about a week ago on Thursday, I think it was, that they were going to build a 2,000-acre solar farm, something like 3 million solar panels, a 30-mile link down to the grid down near Melksham. They were going to use up more than 10 square miles of land. And this is good agricultural land. It's very decent agricultural land. Some of it pasture, some of it arable. They're going to do this and replace it with technology, which, for all we know, will change within a short time.
Two things, I suppose, that we need. We need energy and we need food. And farmers, in a sense, at the moment, have the ability to provide both, because they have this land, which you could turn over to solar panels. But if they do that, if it turns into an industrial solar site, because although they're using the word farm, I don't think there's very much farming going on in the process. If they turn this into an industrial site, what happens to our beef? What happens to our lamb? What happens to our milk?
Well, I'm deeply concerned about climate change, and I'm committed to net zero by 2050. We've got to do something about it. We can't ruin our globe. And solar and other renewables is part of the solution to that. So I'm a strong supporter of renewable energy. However, it's a question of where you want it and how much you want it. And as you correctly say, at a particular time like this, post-Ukraine, we here in Britain have the atmosphere and the weather and the tradition and the ability and the soil to produce food for the world. And to be replacing good agricultural land by vanity mirrors, as I call them, producing energy, it seems to be quite wrong. I'd rather see these solar farms on top of warehouses, down the motorway, down the railway lines, above car parks, above schools. Shortly, as of next year, every house in Britain is new, when they get planning permission, will have to have solar panels on the roof. So that's the kind of place we can have our solar. But to be taking first-class agricultural land and turning it into an industrial site of this kind seems to me to be quite wrong.
Can you understand why, in some ways, a farmer might think, well, why don't I just sell my soul, in a sense, to the environmental, as it may be called, devil? Because they're talking around about £1,000 an acre.
Yes, I mean, I don't blame the farmers themselves. I think if you found a diamond mine under your house, you'd knock your house down, you'd dig the diamonds out. Can't blame you for that. And if you're getting £100,000 a year for a 100-acre patch, or some of them are now 300 or 500 acres, they're talking very substantial amount of money for doing nothing at all, apart from handing the fields over. Well, you can't actually blame them. I don't blame them personally, and many of the farmers in question are friends of mine and will remain friends of mine. I think they'll come to regret it. I think they'll think their job as farmers is to produce food, and to be selling the land for something which may not last more than a few years seems to me to be a great mistake.
What about the future generations of farmers? What legacy will they leave for them if this goes ahead?
Well, it'll be the end of farming in those areas, won't it? Theoretically, these people will be removing these solar panels in 30 or 40 years when the technology's moved on. If you think Macquarie, the Australian investors, will still be here in 30, 40 years and will come along with their lorries and will remove the panels and return it to agriculture, well, you're just wrong. They won't. By then, it'll be a brownfield site, and somebody will come along and say, brownfield site, let's put a factory there. Totally and utterly wrong.
I'm Tracy Worcester, and I live in Badminton. The most important thing that we need to realise is that we need to grow food, and farmers are skilled, and we have to look after our farmers. They are heroes. But presently, they are going bankrupt. So they are very vulnerable to being bribed to actually turn their precious land into an industrial, odious and very dangerous solar park where God knows what it's going to cause, whether it's flooding or a chemical poisoning from cleaning these solar panels, huge fences, and the panels themselves incredibly high. James Gray, the MP, was saying between 5 and 10,000 acres. Now, that's something that the farmers, I'm sure, don't want either. So really, we've got to get together and say to those farmers, come on, this is land that we all love. You love it too. Let's grow our food on that land. Let's support our farmers. Let's buy the food from our farmers. Let's give them a livelihood so that they're not forced to go down this road of really making this area impossible to enjoy. It's odious, and nobody wants it. And those farmers, I'm afraid, are going to lose their community. And that's very sad for them.
One of the groups of people I'm very concerned about are tenant farmers. and the law is not clear as to whether or not the tenant farm will benefit from these solar panels or whether it will be the landlord. And quite a large part of this land is in the Duke of Beaufort's estate and Babington estate, and tenant farmers will be affected. And as I understand it, it is as yet unclear amongst the lawyers as to who gets the money. And that's a very worrying matter. It's only three-generation tenant farmers, and they're possibly facing a bleak future, not because they've done anything, but because the Duke has decided to sell up their heritage. Quite wrong.
That's James Gray, MP, and environmental campaigner Tracy Worcester, talking to Farmers Weekly's Georgie Green. And many local farmers and landowners have been approached by the Australian Macquarie Group to sign up to the solar scheme, but decided against it. And the company says it's planning a series of public meetings over the next 2 weeks in villages affected by the scheme. So, Sandy, soil or solar, food versus fuel, highly controversial, this scheme.
Yeah, I think I need to be careful what I say here, Johan. It's a really difficult one because I've mentioned before that I think we can achieve this balance between the environment and fuel versus food, but we need to play to the strength of the land. And you look at the land that's going to be covered in these solar panels here, and you look and you think, well, that's actually really quite productive arable and livestock land. So you can see why a lot of people would think it's rather short-sighted to take that land out, that good land out of food production, and just cover it entirely in solar panels. So I can see that, I can see the controversy here. I think it would detract from the natural beauty of the area. Most certainly, it's going to become very industrialized, particularly with a 3 meter high security fence around the entire thing. So I can see why people are objecting. But yet at the same time, we do need a degree of energy security, and we do need to be pushing towards a more environmental stance and having more of our energy and electricity come from renewable sources. Whether or not this is the best place to do it is yet to be seen. I think the scale of the development as well is putting a lot of people off. I think it's going to cover over 2,000 acres, which seems potentially to some would seem excessive. But I think we can achieve this balance as long as it's done correctly and it's done in the right places.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpick. I mean, you talk about energy security, food security. Yes, we do need both. I think there's a lot of similarities between the farming and energy sectors. They're both primary industries. We need both food and energy just to survive and keep warm. So food versus fuel. Well, land hasn't always just been used for food production. We do need that mix of both.
I was under the impression, Johan, that these solar panels particularly could be propped up on stilts so you can have sheep and livestock and whatever else can graze underneath them. Now, granted, you couldn't grow crops because you couldn't get machinery in to harvest them. But if it was livestock land, there are some, I believe, solar panels out there that can accommodate that. But looking at the pictures in this article, a lot of the land here is arable.
Yeah, I think you've hit on one of the things about it. It's the scale of the thing, isn't it? You know, this sort of 800 hectares, 2,000 acres. It's a big development, so much so that the energy capacity that it's going to generate exceeds 50 megawatts, which means it's going to be a nationally significant infrastructure project, or classified as such. And that means that a decision on whether it's going to go ahead is going to be taken by the government rather than the local planning authority. So the visual impact is going to be huge, and it's a touristy area and an area that's a much cherished landscape. So you can see why some people are going to be talking about NIMBYs and other people are going to be saying, you know, hey, that's a little bit unfair. This landscape is not only supports agriculture, it supports the wider rural economy and indeed tourism.
The other thing that struck me as being quite comical, Johan, is the fact that the main objector in all of this is the Duke of Beaufort's ex-wife. So whether or not she has some other vested interests in this as well, it just adds to the drama.
Yeah, Tracy Worcester, who you heard on the audio there, is, of course, the Duke of Beaufort's ex-wife, a long-time environmental campaigner. I think older listeners to the Farmers Weekly podcast will probably remember her as an actor, actress in the 1980s. She has a long history of being campaigning for environmental causes, including for higher animal welfare standards in the pig sector a number of years ago. But yeah, as you say, Sandy, it's not only divided the community, it's of course set Tracy Worcester against the Duke of Beaufort in a way that is grabbing the headlines too. And we'll follow that story as it runs and runs with, I believe, the next one of the next decisions on whether that park, that solar farm development is going to go ahead, due to take place later this month.
The Farmers Weekly Podcast.
And finally, farm machinery enthusiast Robert Wilson is set to embark on a six-day challenge, driving his 60-year-old Fordston Super Dexter vintage tractor on a 368-mile route to raise money for three charities. The tractor was originally sold by Robert's father, Andy, to a buyer on the Scottish Isle of Bute 60 years ago. It had never left the island until Robert brought it back in December last year. The special challenge, beginning on Monday the 15th of April, will see Robert and the tractor drive from Ullapool in the north of Scotland, take the ferry to Stornoway, and then continue down the Western Isles on a route that involves a total of six ferry crossings.
My challenge this time is driving a 60-year-old tractor from Stornoway in the Isle of Lewis all the way back to Rothsay in the Isle of Bute. And we're doing it over a period of 6 days. This tractor my father sold onto the Isle of Bute 60 years ago, and it will return to the Isle of Bute on the 15th of April. The challenges are with a 60-year-old driver is the biggest challenge with a 60-year-old tractor. No cabs, so no protection. Anything might go wrong, but hopefully I'll have my toolkit with me and we'll manage to get it over the finish line.
That's 60-year-old farm machinery enthusiast Robert Wilson getting ready to drive his 60-year-old vintage tractor 368 miles for charity. That's a great story there, Sandy. A vintage tractor voyage through the Western Isles, not a part of Scotland I've ever been to. I've most of my forays north of the border, as it were, have been up the East Coast, places like Fife, Inverness, Edinburgh, of course, right up to John O'Groats. But I've never really spent any time on the west coast of Scotland, but nice neck of the woods.
It's beautiful if you can get the weather. I think that's my only caveat, I'd say. I've driven it in a car, and it was hard enough driving in a car, so I really don't fancy doing it in a vintage tractor with zero power steering. So, yeah, it's a great charity run, and it's great to see a lot of the vintage tractors coming out of retirement and being put to good use.
And particularly, well, the nice round numbers here, 60-year-old tractor, 60-year old Robert Wilson. For anybody who would like to know more about that, you can search for Vintage Tractor Voyage through the Western Isles on Facebook. You'll be able to find more details there, including how to follow the progress of Robert and the Fordson Super Dexter, and indeed make a donation for charity. And we wish Robert all the best with that venture. That's it for this episode of the Farmers Weekly podcast. We'll have more news, views, and another entertaining and finally story next week. But for now, thank you for listening. Until next week, I'm Johan Tusker. Goodbye.
And I'm Sandy Kirkpatrick. Goodbye.